When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. We're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Confounding, exhilarating, and contagious. Emotions matter, and so does applying emotional intelligence. Welcome to Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight, the podcast where emotions rule. Whatever the topic, how do hearts and minds collide? Find out with your host, a college professor turned globe-trotting EQ entrepreneur. His mission? Each week, Dan joins prominent authors in decoding how emotions drive outcomes and make people tick. Now, on to the show.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining me for the 122nd episode of my podcast, Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight. The series appears here on the New Books Network, which has as its motto, sharing knowledge so people can thrive. Today's topic is Keep the Rocket in the Air. I'm joined by James Herman. He is the author of Future Demand, Why Building Your Brand Among Tomorrow's Customers is the Key to Startup Success. The publisher is previously unavailable. James is the founding partner of the Innovation Studio, previously unavailable. He's also the co-founder and director of Tracksuit, a brand health tracking company. James has been designated as the world's number one ad agency planning director. He's also the author of a previous book, The Case for Creativity, The Link Between Innovative Marketing and Commercial Success. Welcome to the show, James.
Hey, Dan. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So let's plunge right in. Brief overview of the book. What's this all about?
Yeah, so this is a book that I wrote for primarily for startup founders and leaders of startup companies, just helping them, I guess, think about the importance of the long term when it comes to building their brand and their business. You know, startups are very focused on short term growth for obvious reasons, but the journey from investment into a startup through to some kind of exit event, an IPO or an exit to another company, is usually about 9 or 10 years. And so the book's really about why startups should be thinking about, you know, years 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, rather than just the year that they're in, and orient their marketing around building towards long-term success, not just sort of focusing on how they get sales in the door today. So it's really kind of brings all of the evidence that we've got from the marketing science and effectiveness research communities, brings all that evidence to bear on smaller, younger companies, how they can use marketing to grow sustainably over the long term.
Sure, and fair enough. So one of the really important concepts in the book is this equation of 60-40. Can you enlighten listeners as to what that means and what's its importance to a business profitability, short-term, long-term especially?
Yeah, so yeah, that's right. Great researchers, Les Burnett and Peter Field, working with the data from the UK's Institute of Practitioners in Advertising, a piece of analysis that they did. They looked across many hundreds of case studies at the mix of short term and long term marketing activity in all of those different brands. And they found that the optimal mix was to spend about 40% of your kind of money and resource on short-term activation, so trying to get customers to buy today, and 60% on longer-term brand building. And by that, I mean activity, which is intended to create a sense of kind of familiarity and emotional positivity among the group of customers who perhaps aren't ready to buy today, but will come into the category at some point. And so that 60-40 split really kind of says, you know, we should be spending the majority of our marketing money on doing that longer-term brand-building job and the minority doing that short-term job. And the reason for that, it really comes down to the simple fact that most people who are going to buy from your company are not in the market and ready to buy today, right? So if you think about, you know, really any category, there's going to be a small group of consumers who are ready to buy the product today. They're in the market, they're shopping around. It's going to be a much, much bigger group of people who aren't ready to buy today, but will be at some point in future. And really our job as brand building marketers is to make sure that when those people do come into the category, they lean towards us, they gravitate towards us. And people do that when they're familiar with us before they enter the category, and they've got some kind of positive emotional feeling towards us. So if we can make them feel that way before they're ready to buy, then when they come into the market, they'll gravitate towards us. We'll stand out to them and be more kind of appealing to them. And so that's really about what the principle of future demand is. Future demand means creating demand in the future as opposed to just converting the demand that is available to you today. And those are really quite different marketing jobs, but they both need to happen. And going back to Les and Peter's 60-40 rule, they need to happen at that kind of ratio.
So in other words, you know, the really answer I think I'm hearing is the importance of 60-40 to a business profitability is huge. I mean, you're talking about larger potential audience, gravitating, building emotional momentum so that you can, you know, be in the consideration set and probably prevail if this is done well, all of that, correct?
Yeah, that's right. And yeah, the profitability point is a really important one. So again, what all of the data shows is that companies with strong brands, i.e. brands that are very familiar and have some sort of emotional connection with consumers, those brands are able to charge more money than their competitors. So they're able to put their prices up without losing volume of customers. They're able to justify those higher prices over the long term. And, you know, if you can raise prices by 1%, it's been shown, you know, that usually trickles down to a profit increase of about 8%. So it's hugely beneficial to marketers to be able to raise prices or justify higher prices for the profitability of businesses. And businesses with very weak brands, so brands that aren't very familiar, don't have much of an emotional connection, those companies tend not to be able to raise prices or justify higher prices. So when we're doing that brand building work and that generation of future demand, one of the things that we're also doing is improving our ability to justify higher prices and therefore make greater margins and therefore be more profitable and therefore be more sustainable, because it's much easier to be sustainable when we're working off good margins than when we're just tracking along kind of barely making a crust at the end of the year.
Sure. And to clarify or confirm, did I hear 80 or 8?
Eight. Sorry. Yeah.
Okay.
Only eight.
Yeah.
So 10%.
No. Eight is very attractive. I wanted to make sure I heard you properly, so that everyone's cued in. I by the way, really respect the IPA. I can't remember whether it was Field or Binet that I met with some years ago, but I was really impressed with what they've pulled together. So maybe a small follow-on question, just to stay with the 60-40 future demand thing here for a moment, very explicitly. I imagine because of the IPA's influence, well-earned, that maybe 60-40 is a bit more discussed in the UK than it might be in the US to date. Is that a true summation, or what are you finding?
Yeah, I think that's certainly true. I think the work that Les and Peter have done is very UK-centric, even though they are working with a data set that includes lots of international case studies. It's still quite UK-centric, and certainly its publisher is very UK-centric. And so there is a sort of UK-centricity to it, but certainly the principles that they've uncovered are the same the world over. So it's perfectly reasonable to kind of take what they've discovered with their data and apply it to US companies.
Yeah, no, certainly. I mean, we're talking about neurobiology and how the human psyche is wired, how we build preferences, behavioral economics. All of this, I think, would feed nicely into what the IPA is perhaps focused on more in a UK sort of setting. So if we move to brand, you know, some people find the whole notion of a company's brand a bit amorphous. And I imagine you can help us with this a bit. How would you define a company's brand? Let's maybe start there first.
Yeah. So, I mean, the way that I define it as a brand is a really simple idea that's at the heart of a company, informing every decision that company makes, and also informing its marketing and the way it presents itself to the world. But the point that you make is a really good one, that brand, the idea of brand, it's sort of, you know, I tend to say that marketing has not done a very good job of marketing, and brand does not have a very and brand does not have a very good brand. And a lot of the reason for this, I think, is that in marketing we talk about concepts like brand, we hold them up as being really, really important. But when you ask any marketer to define what a brand is, they often stumble and struggle with that that question. And I think this is something that we're guilty of in marketing. You know, frequently we talk about the importance of insights and how critical it is that we have good insights. Again, if you ask any marketer to define for you what an insight is, they'll really struggle to answer that question in a simple and lucid way. Creativity is another one. We all know that creativity is important. When you ask someone to define what creativity is, they really struggle to do that. And so I think in marketing, we're really guilty of having these notions, these concepts that we say are really important, but then we struggle to define. And if you're someone who works in another area of business, if you work in operations or finance or sales or any of those sorts of areas, you know, you can't really be blamed for being a little bit kind of bemused and befuddled by marketers that hold up these things as very important but struggle to define what they are. So I think that's why, you know, marketing hasn't done a very good job of marketing, and brand doesn't have a very good brand, because you know, we are not clear enough within our own community on what these concepts are and what they mean and what use they are and what their commercial value is and all of those sorts of things. So I think that's an area that we really need to improve.
Well, I've been smiling as you gave that answer, and I respect and enjoy your candidness. It makes me think of a Dilbert cartoon, one of my favorites, where they say, "Welcome to marketing," and there's a big banner overhead that says, "Two drinks minimum."
Yeah.
And I think there at times is some concern about how actionable and practical and so forth it might happen to be. So I love your definition, by the way. If we're talking about actionable levers or components, once we move with that definition forward, I mean, I guess I can start to think about things like projected brand personality, values, motivations. What would you see as the kind of the distinct assets that you start to contemplate when you think about brand and putting brand into action or informing a brand? And I'm aware that a lot of brands, almost the best strokes of luck are indeed strokes of luck, seemingly, in how a brand might come together. But be that as it may, what might you say?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, in terms of sort of putting a brand into action, I think there's just so many different ways you can do that if you actually do accept that brand is a simple idea at the heart of a company that informs everything it does. And sometimes that's externalization in the form of communications, which is about sort of communicating values or giving people a sense of your personality or whatnot. I think where that really falls down is when it's just simply a shiny wrapping paper around a company that doesn't bear much relationship with what actually happens inside the company. So I think the best companies are the ones that the externalization of their brand is simply kind of a way of communicating what is really going on at the heart of that company, and really sort of communicates the actions rather than just resting on words. One of my favorite quotes of all time is from my and probably everyone's favorite 16th century French Roman Catholic friar, St. Francis of Assisi, who said, "Preach the gospel at all times, use words if necessary." And that is a great kind of, I mean, what he's saying, what he's pointing out, which is absolutely true, is that our actions speak a lot louder than our words. So if you look at a company like Patagonia, right? Patagonia is a really great brand. They have very high familiarity. Lots of people know who Patagonia are. Lots of people are very emotionally connected to Patagonia, feel a deep connection with them because of their positioning around saving our home planet and doing things that are environmentally right. And they've done that for years. You know, they haven't just gone out and made ads that says we care about the environment like every other company in the world. They've actually done things which are really, really interesting and have actually made what I call symbolic sacrifices, which are times when a company actually sacrifices something in the short term for their beliefs to show that their beliefs are actually truly their beliefs and not just a bunch of marketing rubbish. And so Patagonia, you know, one of the things they did years ago was they ran an ad that said, "Don't buy this jacket." And they were encouraging people, rather than, you know, buying a Patagonia piece of clothing and then sort of wearing it out, throwing it away and coming and buying another one, you know, we'll sell you a jacket, and anytime you need that jacket repaired, we'll repair it. So just bring it back and we'll kind of stitch it back up and make it new again. And then you can go on wearing that, because it's much better for the planet that we reuse and recycle things than it is that we just, you know, throw stuff away in our consumerist culture, which is leading to all sorts of issues. And so for a long time, they've been doing those things which are sort of sacrificial. You know, they've said in that case, we're happy to sacrifice some sales to build a stronger relationship with our environment, a stronger relationship with our customers, and prove that we mean what we say. And then more recently, obviously, when the founder gave the company away effectively to a bunch of environmental causes and donated all future profits of the company to those environmental causes, that was another, you know, enormous symbolic sacrifice of saying, you know, I'm really serious about this company doing the right thing and really working to save our home planet. And that's why I've done this. And so I think that's, you know, Patagonia are probably the most probably the most intense example of a company really having a strong idea at its heart and decision making around that. But, you know, other companies like Allbirds are another company that I like a lot, who have really oriented themselves around their core idea of making better things in a more sustainable way. And, you know, Nike have for a long time, you know, done a lot of things which put their kind of money where their mouth is, like the Colin Kaepernick piece from a few years ago. And so it's those, I tend to think that the best brands are built when there's a real clarity and a real connection between what the company really does and what it says it does.
Sure. Well, I had Nike's creative director on the program a few months ago, and I just watched Kaepernick in America, a documentary at a film festival here this past weekend. And certainly the Patagonia example stands out, and you being a New Zealander with the wonderful beauty of your country, it makes plenty of sense why you would revere a company that respects and looks out for the environment. So we had some terms earlier about branding and so forth. I wanted to throw another one. A good friend of mine worked in major ad agencies in New York and LA. He said, here's my definition of creativity in a business context, particularly an ad agency. He said, to me, it's, are you creating the emotions in your target audience that are conducive to making the sale? So it was around the creating of the emotional resonance. So in your book, and I don't often get this chance because your book is truly honoring and exploring the importance of emotions, you've got various emotional categories that you bring up: belonging and reassurance and enjoyment. And I was hoping you might, we don't have a lot of time, but I wanted you to delve in a few of these if you might. I don't know if you think of them in terms of a color wheel, and some are natural companions or opposites from one another. But if you can tell me a bit about how you constructed those emotional categories, what's in them, what really maybe stands out for you, I'd welcome that.
Yeah. So, yeah, going back to the start of that piece, I mean, one thing that we've we've sort of accepted as a marketing community for quite some time is that creating an emotional connection is important. Brands which people feel emotionally close to are much more powerful than brands that people feel no sense of emotional closeness to. And one of the most, one of my favorite findings from the IPA work that we've been talking about was that if you feel emotionally close to a company, you're likely to conclude for yourself that their products are of a higher quality and are superior without those facts needing to be presented to you. And this is kind of the wonderful trick of great branding, is that we make people feel a certain way that allows them to conclude rationally that we're better without us needing to actually be better or to, spend lots of money trying to convince people and persuade people that we are.
And in that way, they basically sell themselves based on the trust in what they're feeling.
Yeah. Totally. I mean, people's emotional connection to Apple is such that they will, as Samsung and other competitors bring out rationally superior products sooner than Apple, Apple users will just wait and pay more for a often rationally inferior Apple product on the basis of the connection that they feel with that company. And so that's sort of a really good example. But going back to the emotional spectrum, I mean, where that was born from was saying, well, we know we need to create an emotional connection, but what kind of emotional connection specifically are we trying to create? Because the human emotional spectrum is extremely broad. There are so many different emotions that we are capable of feeling. Depressingly, about 2/3 of them are negative emotions, and 1/3 of them are positive emotions. And normally, with a brand, we want to connect on the basis of some kind of positive emotion. And so, what I did looking at that kind of, the science and the work that's been done around studying and identifying that range, that gamut of human emotions, really looking at the positive ones. Turning those into kind of 9 broad categories of emotion, and then comparing those to brands and how brands kind of connect. And so, as you're saying, one of those groupings is about belonging. It's about creating feelings of kind of inclusion and acceptance and value and respect. And so if you think about a brand like Dove, for example, the campaign for Real Beauty, that's really trying to make women feel accepted, respected, valued. And so their brand is really around belonging, as is a brand like Airbnb. Their whole tagline is belong anywhere. Again, they're wanting to stimulate emotions around feeling included and accepted. And so on through these kind of 9 categories. So if you think of a brand like Volvo, their safety positioning, that's all about around making us feel a sense of reassurance in their product. If you look at a brand like Nike, it's all about motivation. It's about making us feel kind of ambitious and courageous. If you think about Coca-Cola, it's all about making us feel happy. If you think about a brand like Allbirds, it's all about making us feel optimistic that the future can be better. So all of these brands, they tend to really try and activate a specific kind of emotion in us. And they do that over the long term, kind of again and again and again and again, through everything that they put out into the world. And so we developed the spectrum really to kind of enable marketers or business leaders to say, what is the emotion we want people to feel when they interact with our brand? Whether that's thinking about our brand, using our product, coming into contact with our marketing, what specifically is the emotion that we want people to feel? And once we've got that specificity, it becomes so much easier to think about, well, what should our personality be and what should our messages be? Once we know the emotion that we're trying to stimulate in people, it actually becomes quite easy to figure out kind of how to do that. It's quite a logical step from there. But we very rarely start thinking about what is that specific emotion that we want to engage in people.
Oh, no, I completely agree. I would say often in business, we're at the risk of being emotionally illiterate and draw a bit of a blank slate when we're trying to look at those things. Or I can even remember, quite honestly, meeting with an ad agency in London And I said, they said, well, we're really trying to explore emotions. And I said, you know, specifics, where are you trying to get to? And they said, well, the emotion we're most interested in is consideration. And I said, well, I'm not sure that's an emotion, but let's keep talking.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so funny. I mean, I think, yeah, we're really guilty of that. I mean, we think about emotion in a very, you know, in ad agencies and in, when we're planning comms, we tend to reduce it back to, you know, should we make people laugh or should we make them cry? And that, again, is kind of, it's so super generic. And of course, there is value in comedy, and there's value in making people, you know, engaging people emotionally in a way that they feel sort of, you know, very sad and then very happy, as many kind of very emotional pieces of advertising do. But deeper than that, we've got to go, actually, what is the emotion that we want our brand to engage in people over the long term? And then present that in a funny way or a way that makes people cry or whatever. But yeah, you're right. We should be more emotionally literate, and we should be digging deeper than just saying we want to create an emotional connection.
Sure. So maybe one last question before we wrap up here. So I agree with you earlier that one of the errors that can happen in branding is, you know, it's very amorphous, and you could also just use it as a shiny wrapper and doesn't really tie to how you're intrinsically running the company. Are there other brand building errors that particularly stand out for you?
Other brand building errors, did you say?
Yeah. Mistakes that get made that if only they could be guided in a better direction would make all the difference.
Yeah. Man, there are actually so many. I mean, the sort of the prime contender for me tends to be around short-termism. So often, you know, we flip-flop around as brands and we don't stick to, you know, a really consistent message over the long term. What we know from all of the data is that when we stick to a kind of a platform or a strategy over the long term, that's the effectiveness of that strategy tends to compound, i.e. it gets more and more effective as it goes. So I'll give you some examples. You know, Snickers, you're not you when you're hungry. That's a strategy that's been running since 2008. It's been executed, like, you know, just dozens and dozens and dozens of different ways all over the world. And it just gets more and more effective. Dove's campaign for real beauty started in 2004. Again, it's still going today and still producing amazing results. The John Lewis work for by Adam and Eve DDB in London, their Christmas campaign that they do every year. Again, you know, that just continues to kind of get more and more effective the more that they do it. So I think that's one thing that we are really guilty of as marketers is we run a brand campaign and then we kind of turn it off and then we go back to the drawing board and we reinvent the brand completely and we go out with a completely new message in this kind of absolutely fallacious belief that that strategies and campaigns wear out, which they, you know, there's really very little evidence to support the idea that that good campaigns wear out. Shit campaigns wear out, but if your creative's not good, no good, it's not going to wear out over a number of months. It's going to be worn out by the time the consumer gets to the end of your commercial. But good work, you know, good creative work, it doesn't wear out. It can be run for a long, long time. And so I think that's one thing that as marketers we're really guilty of is we don't abide by that. We kind of chop and change and do something new, and, you know, a marketing director leaves and a new one comes along and changes everything. And, you know, that's hugely to the detriment of organizations' long-term growth. So I think that's something we need to really change.
Yeah, no, I love that answer. And, you know, it's kind of jump cut editing version of branding way too often. And about the time that it's resonating with the audience, people inside the headquarters building seem to get tired of it, or somebody's decided it's time to move on and put their own stamp on things.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the idea that I really love, the piece of advice I really love, is that when you as a marketer are so sick of your campaign that you can't even bear to see or hear it anymore, that's when the consumer is just starting to get it. Just starting to kind of understand it, because, you know, you care as a marketer an awful lot about your work and you pay an awful lot of attention to it and it surrounds you. The consumer does not give a fuck. Frankly, they have so many better things going on in their lives than your ad. And so, you know, for them to notice it and to engage with it enough for them to get bored of it takes such a long time, years and years and years. And so we need to kind of be more cognizant of the massive difference between the amount that we engage with our marketing and the amount that the consumer does.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And candidly stated and on the mark. So I want to thank you, James, for being my guest. This is Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight. It's episode 122, Keep the Rocket in the Air. My guest, James Herman, he is the author of Future Demand, Why Building Your Brand Among Tomorrow's Customers is the Key to Startup Success. If you enjoyed today's show, please give it a rating or review on iTunes. Finally, I'd like to conclude every episode with an epigram. In this case, I chose one from Lisa Gransky, who said, "A brand is a voice and a product is a souvenir." Until next time, take care and be well.